Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is pleased to provide David Goodman's Vermont Conversations with underwriting from National Life Insurance, Fairpoint Communications, by Let's Grow Kids, The Alchemist Brewery, the University of Vermont Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, and Green Mountain Power, as well as over 750 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. We're continuing our conversations about new solutions to old problems. In our second half here, we're joined by David Grant. He is the former president and CEO of the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation. He's also a co-founder of the Mountain School in Verchere, Vermont. He consults with people and organizations that have a social or educational mission. His new book is called The Social Profit Handbook, The Essential Guide to Setting Goals, Assessing Outcomes, and Achieving Success for Mission-Driven Organizations. David Grant, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So let's start by having you explain, what is social profit?
Well, you know, the title, The Social Profit Handbook, came out of conversations that I've had for years with people who are just left cold by the phrase nonprofit. The social sector organizations, which their tax status is nonprofit organizations, but it doesn't say what they do. And so because I'm very interested in assessment, I'm interested in how they talk about, how they reckon their success and how they talk about it, I thought, let's come right out and say what they are, which is social profit organizations, and then look at a different way of approaching assessment as sort of a door to walk through to achieving that social profit.
What is it that you object to about the traditional term nonprofit?
Well, I don't know. It doesn't make my heart beat faster. I don't know what it does for you. But
I always feel like I have to ask, is that nonprofit by choice or by predicament?
Well, you know, and actually, I think it puts the emphasis on the wrong thing, because if you have a healthy nonprofit that's actually doing well and generating a bit of a surplus, people look at them as if they've abandoned their mission. And, of course, that's not true at all, is you need healthy organizations to pursue complicated social missions. So I like the word profit because we all understand that, you know, profit is worth investing in. And so I think the whole sector is worth investing in, and I think strong social sector organizations, you know, deserve a lot of attention, which I think they're getting.
Why did you write this book?
It stemmed from years of doing workshops with what I then called nonprofit organizations down in New Jersey. I'd been here in Vermont for quite a while, and then late 40s, I had a chance to go down to New Jersey and become president of the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, which is a mid-sized, very creative, innovative regional foundation that supports arts, education, environment. And because my career up to then had been as a teacher, I took an educational outlook to the whole job and to the sector and to the relationships, and set up with my colleagues at Dodge what we called a technical assistance initiative. It was essentially capacity building for the people that Dodge supported, the people and the organizations. And I started to give workshops, and they grew, and pretty soon people were saying, you know, you better write a book about this. And then that kept happening. And when I left the Dodge Foundation, I actually had time to write the book.
You talk about the need to take social profit organizations from good to great. How do you do that?
Well, a lot of it is giving them mechanisms and tools for figuring out themselves what that means. I spend an entire chapter in the book on the concept of mission time, which I still think is one of the most valuable takeaways. Everything else aside, just the idea that mission-driven organizations should pause and reflect on what exactly it is they're doing, what's the world they're operating in, how do they know if they're being successful, what relationships do they need to build that they don't have now, how do they talk to each other? How do they communicate about their successes and their challenges and their failures? How do they learn from their failures? Most are working so hard directly on mission that they don't have that quality of time. And when they do it, they're in a retreat mode, which happens when they change leadership or maybe every 5 years or something like that. So I really urge them to build in mission time within the staff and then between the staff and board. And then board meetings should be about mission time. They shouldn't be about reports. They should be about the long-term strategic objectives of the organization. And so that's a shift that I advocate right away, which I think is part of going from good to great. The other is to realize that outside assessors are not concerned about them being great. I think they're concerned about them being legal and about their financial house being in order. But I think real greatness in program and in delivery of social profit is defined locally and is created locally.
So give me an example of that. What is a local component for, say, an entity that's working on issues in a much larger area?
Well, let's just take imagine a social service nonprofit in White River Junction, and they have to report back to their funders. Well, they have to report on how money is used, particularly with government funding. You know, it's a real anti-fraud sort of accounting. They might be interested in people in numbers served, and without an alternative definition of great success, numbers served is sort of a proxy for success. But let's just take an arts program for youth, and you serve 10 kids or 10 teenagers, and the experience is transformational. It literally raises confidence and broadens horizons and creates a different way of thinking and being in the world. But then a funder says, well, get your numbers up, you got to serve 20 next year, but they don't have the capacity to do that. So they stretch it thin and water it down, and the whole program feels like it's out of gas. What I'm advocating is for the kind of assessment where when the funder says, you got to get your numbers up, you say, no, here's what our program accomplishes, and this is why we can do it for this number of people. And if you want to get our numbers up, you're going to have to build our capacity, because with our capacity now, this is what we're doing, and this is what our mission looks like in action. I think it's that notion about if you draw back, and some people find themselves in the position of feeling like they're fulfilling their mission by sort of having people come through the door. That's not really their mission. Their mission is about quality of service and impact on lives.
So normally when somebody writes a book, it's because they see a problem that they want to solve. Can you give me a real-world example of, an organization that essentially hits a plateau? And I think that's a lot of what you're describing, when groups kind of just stall. Give me an example.
Sure.
Of...
Well, problems, this is very layered, isn't it? And that, you can think about problems in terms of one organization or one community, and then you can think big. I mean, I know you often are thinking statewide, and it's a context of society-wide when you're interviewing folks. And I actually begin my book with a global view of the world being in a mess. And we say, well, what in the world can any of us do about it? I actually think, particularly in our country, we have this vibrant social sector. We've always had it, which is to say not government, not business, but, an actual sector that is it's mission-driven, where it's not reckoned in dollars. In fact, they even call themselves non-profit. I've already mentioned, I think that's a bit of a problem. I think they're social profit organizations. I think if we can strengthen them individually and collectively, we're going to help ameliorate a number of problems, some of which seem intractable. I think you have to do it organization by organization, and as they get stronger, they're able to interact with each other better. They're able to be in partnership and coalition. They're able to they become clearer about their mission, and they see who their natural allies are. I can tell you a story. I'll tell you one quick story of an organization in New Jersey that started to do this assessment work, and it broadened their sense of the possible. And it's had an enormous impact around the country. It was a faith-based environmental organization called Green Faith. And they were founded with this notion of stewardship and feeling that churches, synagogues, mosques should be models of environmental practice. And so they started with the idea that they'd put solar panels on the roof and get better insulation and furnaces. And then they came to an assessment workshop where we started to say, well, you know, what would success really look like for you in greening and all its aspects? And that took them into the worship service. It took them into religious education. It took them into how they invest the money, the congregations that had money to invest. Were they investing it in a green way? And they kept developing this tool themselves that said, well, what does success look like? What would greening really look like? And it morphed into a nationwide certification program for green houses of worship. And when I last checked, they had 39 different states represented. And so you can see what's happened is that they've elevated the conversation. They've changed the way people think about sort of the role of religious congregations in the environmental field. And then they set up a mechanism where people are rewarded for that sort of behavior.
Is this, you talk about, you know, your book is titled The Social Profit Handbook. Does what you talk about relate to mission-driven businesses? So these would be for-profit enterprises?
Yes, it does. You know, one of the real eye-opening things for me since I wrote the book, and I've been doing some readings around Vermont and elsewhere, is half the people coming up to me afterwards work in for-profit businesses. And they've said, everything you've said is applicable. And they said that, you know, most businesses, of course, have more than just a financial mission. They want to be good neighbors. They want to make positive impacts on their communities. And then with the B Corp, with the L3Cs in Vermont, that there's a stated mission, and everything I write in the book is exactly for them. It's for an organization that says, how do we get together on exactly what our social mission is and what it would look like, so specifically that we can plan backwards from it and achieve it.
We're talking today with David Grant, the author of the new book, The Social Profit Handbook, The Essential Guide to Setting Goals, Assessing Outcomes, and Achieving Success for Mission-Driven Organizations. You can join the conversation at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. I want to shift gears for a moment to ask you about the Mountain School. You're the co-founder of the Mountain School. For people who don't know what it is, tell us.
Glad to. The Mountain School now is a semester-long program on a working farm in Verchere, Vermont. It used to be a four-year school, actually from the early 60s to the early 80s. It was a four-year school that had been founded by a couple who had been on the faculty of the Putney School. And I guess they felt Putney was too big because they actually set up a smaller version of it in Verchere. But it never thrived sufficiently in its enrollment that it could make a go of it. And it closed after 20 years. My wife and I were teaching at Milton Academy, which is south of Boston and one of the venerable old New England independent schools. But in the summers, we worked for the Appalachian Mountain Club. And it was through one of our AMC friends that we heard about this really kind of great school in Vermont that had gone out of business. And we went up to visit with Mac and Doris Connor, who were the founders of the original school. And they looked at us, as we were 30 years younger and, you know, had a lot of energy, and they said, maybe you guys could bring the school back. And we looked at the school and said, we don't think it should be a four-year school. We think it should be a semester-long school for kids from all over the country who are interested in resource management, how small communities work, environmental issues, the whole relationship between humankind and the natural world. I mean, what a place to study those questions. This spectacularly beautiful hilltop farm in Verscher. And so we set it up. The Milton Academy agreed to sort of sponsor it. And we got a coalition of other New England schools and some in New York and Ohio, actually. And we just took a flyer on it. We tried it. That was 32 years ago. And it's still going strong. It's, you know, we now have 3,000 graduates.
Are you still involved with it?
Well, I sit on their advisory board, which has been, which is great. You know, I it's like going back, it must be like being a grandparent or something, because it just, I just look and it's thriving. I just love watching it and I don't have to worry about it.
So does the school, I know that it's been written up in the New York Times periodically, and it attracts, as you say, students from a lot of top private schools.
Yeah.
Does it have many Vermont students go attend?
It does. Actually, now there's a quite a steady relationship with Thetford Academy, with Sharon Academy, Chelsea High School, Hanover High School. Basically, the high schools, if you draw a 50-mile circle around Verscher or 40, maybe 30-mile circle around Verscher, most of those high schools have sent students who are eager to do this. And that's been fantastic for the students who come from elsewhere, particularly from cities.
What do you think the need is, or what's your vision for, you know, what this fulfills that isn't fulfilled at some of these well-known prep schools?
Well, you know, it has several dimensions. Maybe I'll start with the academic one, is that I personally have always been interested in interdisciplinary work. And schools, high schools, are set up academically like many colleges. You know, they set up by courses and departments, and sometimes the individual departments don't know what each other's doing, and they war over student time. And so and it's very hard to change that. Habits are deep. And so what we did was actually start a new school based on interdisciplinary study, with some essential questions that you then pursued with the skills of history and the insights of English and the, you know, the principles of science and scientific method. And often students would say to us they weren't sure which class they were in. They just knew that they were connecting knowledge. That's what we were after. And then the other part had to do with students accepting responsibility for so many parts of their lives. The Mountain School students raise their own food. They manage the woodlots. In the spring they sugar. They run the school meetings. And for 11th graders, they're all 11th graders. I don't know if I mentioned that, but they're all 11th graders, which is a time when people are ready to accept that level of responsibility, and they rise to the occasion. And what we hear now from graduates who are in their 40s. Are that 4 months in Verscher was the sort of the transformative time educationally for them, where they got to think about who they wanted to be in the world. They got to figure out how they were in a community, how they related to others. They felt that great feeling when you're pulling together for the common good, and they're all doing terrific, interesting things now as adults.
Just, you know, wondering the other thing about junior year. It's also a time of where all the college, you know, the SATs, all those sort of college prep things that people are focused on. It might be a time when, you know, kids who are student athletes are really, you know, peaking. How does it work for them to pull out of that and go to this farm in Vermont?
Well, of course, that was the big question when we began. There are people saying, really, junior year? You're going to mess with junior year? And we said, well, what we have in mind is a peak experience. And we knew, I taught enough seniors to know that seniors have a foot out the door. And sophomores are, particularly the boys, not quite mature enough to do what we had in mind. And so junior year is a real sweet spot, and we said, let's create something so powerful that not only will it not be a problem for college, it will enhance college. And that's what turned out to be true. We, after the first group of students applied to and got into college, that's never been an issue. In fact, the only issue has been parents pushing kids to apply because they think it'll be so good for their college sort of profile. The thing about SATs and the like, you know, you can just take them. We just go down to Hanover and take them. But it's in a curious way, it's connected to the measurement issues that I talk about in the Social Profit Handbook, because I say that we have to be careful we're not measuring the wrong thing. And a curriculum that thinks success is measured in its standardized test scores runs the problem of focusing on them so wholly that the test scores actually go down because the students are disengaged. And so the best way to have great test scores are to have students who are alive and really engaged in all their subjects, and they're using language and they're writing, and they do just fine. So we actually found that using junior year wasn't a problem academically at all. Athletically, you're right that it's a big thing to give up. You have to give up one season, not the whole year. And as a result, I think we probably have lost some boys. We don't seem to lose as many girls because they just they seem to have that kind of maturity at that age where they weigh things and they go, well, this is what I'm giving up, but here's what I'm getting. And interestingly, this is a little gender stereotypical here, but their coaches, the women coaches, tend to support the athletes in having an adventure up here in Vermont, and the boys coaches say, you know, you'll never hold your head up high in this town again, boy. So we have lost a few because of boys coaches.
So, David Grant, I know another hat that you wear is kind of a tweed hat, and that is that you've toured the world doing a one-man show as Mark Twain.
That's right.
We learn from Mark Twain?
You know, Mark Twain was, I was so lucky about this that I, as an undergraduate, I was in a program that, where you wrote a thesis, and I decided to write on Mark Twain. It was the first time I think I'd taken a deep dive into a particular writer or thinker language, and it's a year-long project and a 100-and-some-page thesis, and I came out of it seeing the world differently and loving the complicated nature of Mark Twain's humor, and also his sense of both the promise and the challenges of American democracy, all the sort of great stuff, and his language in the end is so wonderful, so compelling, that when I started teaching in the mid-70s, I was at a school that was a bicentennial celebration, and the woman who was running the fine arts department said to me, oh, you know, everybody knows you love Mark Twain, why don't you put on a white suit, why don't you spray your hair white? You know, I was 26 years old, and so I said, all right, And I did a little reading. I did the whitewash fence scene from Tom Sawyer. And the reaction of my students was kind of electric. You know, they were standing and shouting and hooting. And I was hooked. So I started learning more and more. And at one point I had 2.5 to 3 hours of Mark Twain's material memorized.
Okay, so we don't have 2.5 to 3 hours, but we might have 2 or 3 minutes. Could you give us a passage from Mark Twain?
Well, let me see if I. It's been a while, but let me. Here's how he used to start his. He used to call them at homes. You know, his little lectures where he'd be on stage by himself, and he'd be clouded with cigar smoke, and he'd look at the audience, and he'd go, "Ladies and gentlemen, I wish to present to you a man whose great learning and veneration for truth are exceeded only by his high moral character and majestic presence. I refer in these vague general terms
to myself. I consider introductions unnecessary. But if it is the custom to have them, I prefer to do the act myself, so I can rely on getting in all the facts. I was born modest, but it wore off.
And what is that from?
That's from one of his speeches. You know, he was so well known in the 1890s that all his speeches were reported in newspapers. So there are literally volumes and volumes of his speeches that you can turn to and research.
So tell me the most quotable or the wisest thing that you carry with you from Mark Twain that you carry with you in your work and life today.
Well, I really shouldn't carry this with me. I'm the worst for it. But I remember in his 70th birthday speech, when he was talking about how he got to be 70 years old, he said it was by following habits that would kill anybody else. And he mentioned exercise. And he said, exercise. Exercise is loathsome. Whenever I get the urge to exercise, I lie down until it goes away.
Well, I don't know if that's a really great note to end on in terms of the message, but it certainly is in terms of the way you've delivered it. So I think we'll use Mark Twain then to wrap it up here. David Grant, I want to thank you for joining us this week for this very wide-ranging Vermont conversation.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.
David Grant is the author of the new book, The Social Profit Handbook, The Essential Guide to Setting Goals, Assessing Outcomes, and Achieving Success for Mission-Driven Organizations, just published by Chelsea Green. He's also a co-founder of The Mountain School, and as we just heard, a Mark Twain, somebody who channels Mark Twain. So you can hear this and all Vermont Conversations at vermontconversation.com, and you can find out about VBSR's upcoming annual spring concert, celebrating 25 years by going to vbsr.org. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. We'll be back next Wednesday at 1 here on WDEV.
You have been listening to Vermont Conversations with David Goodman, made possible by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its 750-plus members. Additional support is provided by National Life Insurance for over 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. By Fairpoint Communications, small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By the Alchemist Brewery, serving Greater Waterbury and Vermont since 2003. And Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By the University of Vermont Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine.
And you are listening to the stations of Radio Vermont, WDEV, FM, and AM. Time now to update the very latest world and national news.
Have to work together to end the mistrust and the violence,
which is developing a respectful conversation within the Baltimore community and across the nation about the way our law enforcement officers interact.